fully influential in my musical life, and I think the entire Houston music scene, it's a beacon for music, arts, songwriting, Americana, roots music, things that you can't hear anywhere else. It's amazing. It's the local flavor that when you're driving across the country, you hope to find, you know, while you're on a road trip or something. You're not just hearing the same stuff on the streaming platforms, whatever, and you get to hear what's here. You get to hear what came here before, and it's really great. It's an education that everybody needs to hear these incredible songs. It's just an amazing opportunity for local and regional musicians.
Listen for his music and other independent artists here on KPFT Houston.
Hey, check it out, y'all. This is A.B. Haddon, Cowboy World. Get ready for Western World Radio on 90.1 KPFT Houston Wednesday evenings at 6 p.m.
And we are talking about science fiction tonight with author Dr. Martin Halbert. He is a librarian and digital library innovator whose career has featured decades of experimental work in developing cultural research, data, and collaborative institutional change. He served as the co-principal investigator for the Transatlantic Slave Trade Database, which is one of the most prominent international sources of information on the history of trafficking in enslaved Africans. He was also the founder of Educopia, a nonprofit organization that promotes knowledge sharing and capacity building among organizations, communities, individuals. I take a breath because he's got a lot of bona fides. He served as a dean of the libraries of two research universities. He's now a tenured professor, University of North Carolina at Greensboro. He recently completed 4 years as program director and science advisor for the United States National Science Foundation, in the Office of Advanced Cyber Infrastructure, and also the Office of the Director, where he worked on open science policy. And he is also now a science fiction author, and we'll be talking tonight about his book here on Vegan World Radio. And this is KPFT, as you may probably know, but just in case you don't, we are a volunteer-powered, nonprofit, genuinely community radio station. We just went through our fund drive. We want to thank everybody that donated to keep this thing going after all these years, ever since the 70s, when a bunch of pacifist idealists got together and wanted to bring a space for thought to the Houston airwaves, and we've been doing it ever since then. Thank you to each of you that donated, particularly to the Vegan World Radio program. You help keep us in the mix here. And tonight, on this 9th of March, we are live in the studio with Martin Halbert. We just heard about his long and distinguished bona fides. And hey, Martin, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you very much to Vegan World Radio for having me on. It's a great honor.
Well, so I understand that you have written a book.
I have indeed. Actually, two books that I can tell you a little bit about tonight. And I, in the course of writing these, I thought a lot about actually veganism and just rights of sentient beings broadly. And as a result, I have a lot to say about a lot of thoughts on veganism and science fiction, and can tell you both about the books and that topic.
Yeah, because veganism is the topic of the program, but I'm really interested in maybe going even a little farther afield in thoughts that are brought up by your book and by your research and just things in the world in general. I understand that this book that you wrote was inspired by a journey to the West, which is you know a lot more about it than I do, but I understand it's like a Chinese, ancient Chinese work of literature that has to do with there's a monk, and he has a friend that's a monkey, is all I know. And he goes to India, and he brings back the sacred scrolls of Buddhism, and is credited with bringing Buddhism to China.
Is that... that is a perfect summary, Pietro. Very, you did your homework.
I know there's a monkey in there somewhere.
there's the monkey is the main character. The monkey is named Sun Wukong, and this is the most prominent saga in classical Chinese literature, actually, and a lot of people will know about it. It has inspired just countless interpretations, you know, versions of it. Among them, you know, one people may be familiar with in pop culture, in Japanese manga and anime, is Dragon Ball Z. So actually, yeah, the Journey to the West inspired DBZ, actually. But it is a classical story. It's a very long, robust story that has a lot to say about enlightenment and beings and respect for others and all sorts of wonderful topics. And yes, it was the inspiration for these books, actually.
Well, I guess we couldn't say that the Journey to the West is the original, like, buddy road trip story, because, you know, Epic of Gilgamesh is arguably older. It's up there for ancient buddy road trip stories.
Right? It's up there. It's not just the monkey and the monk. It's a ensemble cast that the monk, typical of a lot of Eastern storytelling. The story is the early parts of the story are occupied with forming up the team, so to speak, and turning individuals that are initially adversaries into friends and allies. And similar to that, that's what happens in at least the first book of my series, Helmsman. And the second book, Pilgrim, continues the story with some more adventures and filling out the team, so to speak.
Well, the team in your book also consists of not just human characters, but also, I believe, the main character apparently, like, really has a thing for this this giant female cyborg.
Close, not quite, but yes. And in fact, it's similar to Journey to the West. In Journey to the West, the monk is the only human in the group too. Though everybody else in it is a monster or a demon, basically, that he's befriended, so to speak. So yeah, the characters in the book are all about, they are actually the female character that you're referring to isn't a cyborg. She is an alien, but she's a half human hybrid alien. So and then he does befriend this character that is the equivalent of Sun Wukong, who is quite the figure in Chinese mythology. And then another figure that I won't say too much about it because it'll give away all the plot elements. But
I didn't know how far you want to do with the spoilers.
Yeah, I'm trying to avoid too many spoilers. But yes, those are some of the main characters in this team that gets assembled in both Journey to the West and this story, my books.
Okay, well, I mean, without giving away the events of the book, I mean, what was your thinking regarding, like, consciousness in general, and given that a lot of your characters are not purely human,
like, sure.
Like, what is consciousness like, and what consciousness is worthy of ethical consideration?
So let me give you a little background to understand these books. So my two science fiction novels that were just published in late February they're called Helmsman and Pilgrim, like I was saying, and they are the first two books in what I'm calling the Sojourner saga of novels, and they take place in this distant future when humanity has long since colonized the stars. And when I started working on these books years ago, I really wanted them to feel real, and I did a lot of world building to sort of think through the future of humanity and how we would explore space. And as I thought about those long-term prospects for humans living in isolated planets out in the galaxy in circumstances where they can't initially travel faster than light, I realized, Well, it's quite likely that a lot of those civilizations on distant colonies might collapse into primitive conditions under either environmental or social conditions, all sorts of things. And so by the time that this Sojourner series of novels starts, many, many human civilizations throughout a huge area of the galaxy have indeed collapsed, becoming dying societies that are called in the story, in the novels, the bereft. And the novels are focused on core themes of mutualism, symbiosis, and altruism, which I can explore a little bit here. And that's reflected in the main characters. So the main group that the series starts with are called Sojourners. That's why the series is called the Sojourner Saga. And who are they? They're an altruistic, scientific, monastic order of monks that are dedicated to finding and aiding those bereft, collapsed civilizations and helping them. But after a millennium of saving those societies, this order, this interstellar order of information monks has fallen on hard times because less civically minded governments decided to defund them, which is a circumstance that we can relate to in our current environment.
Yeah, thank goodness we don't have to worry about any kind of short-sightedness like that in our own government, right?
That's right. So the novels of this Sojourner Saga follow the travels of a young Sojourner acolyte monk named Grimalkin Thomas, who volunteers to go on a quest to explore the secrets of this distant and enigmatic cluster of stars in the vicinity of Eta Carinae, which is a real place and is arguably, a lot of astronomers have argued it's the most interesting stellar system in the galaxy because it's basically two colliding gigantic stars that circle each other, slamming into each other every few years. When every time they slam into each other, it's an explosion that's almost as big as a supernova. But anyway, so this young monk goes there, and this is the area where he makes new enemies and allies among these strange beings that inhabit the cluster. And the series does explore a lot of topics in symbiosis and mutualism and how different cultures, different species, and different, you know, even orders of creature, like, you know, you mentioned cyborgs. Yes, there's a lot of cyborgs in the series. How they can either hurt each other or help each other. And, you know, what the motivations for those kinds of interactions are. And there's a number of ways I explore that in the books, and I'd be happy to explore any of that or any vegan topics that you'd like me to.
Well, I mean, we can definitely want to see where this conversation takes us. And I'm going to ask just the facts, ma'am, about the books, but I'm also,
yes,
also probably be mentioning some of my own political opinions, but politics and science fiction are not strangers by any means, right? There's a long tradition of that.
Absolutely they are. And veganism, for that matter, too, you know, is a key topic in a lot of science fiction. I mean, because it's part of the larger topic that so much of science fiction deals with, of encountering other kinds of sentient beings and what that encounter might be like. You know, a lot of the many, you know, whole categories of science fiction deal with encountering aliens that, you know, somehow want to do us harm. And many of those early, I mean, right from the get-go, a lot of those stories held up an uncomfortable kind of mirror, I think, to human behaviors that are just like these aliens. You know, that so the famous early one was Damon Knight's short story To Serve Man,
right?
That became, if you remember that one, that also became an episode of the Twilight Zone, the original Twilight Zone.
It's and a recipe book.
It's yeah.
So I gave it
exactly.
away. Spoilers.
We should say that a lot of these are probably going to be spoilers. I'm trying to avoid those, but some of them to talk about it at all, you have to do a little spoiler. So if you hear, if anybody listening hears a story that you don't want to know something about, just skip ahead or silence it for a minute or two. So in To Serve Man, you know, humanity thinks they're being uplifted and helped by this superior species aliens that they encounter. And the ironic twist is, yes, exactly, this book that they find, that they steal from the aliens, that they think when they decode it, the title is To Serve Man. So they think, oh, it's great, they're going to help us, right? Well, but as you just said, well, when they fully translate it, they realize it's a cookbook. And so the twist is that, yeah, they aren't helping us because they care about us, but just to eat us. Yeah. And it's a direct mirror of how we view lesser species. And it was one of the first prominent works that I know of that introduced this basic question in pop culture that, well, if superior intelligence is the only thing that gives a species the right to eat other species, well, what happens when something smarter than us comes along?
Absolutely. Another prime example is H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds, where it's essentially an allegory about the European nation's history of imperialism. Because, like, what if the shoe was on the other foot? Like, here come these aliens with this advanced technology that we basically have no defense against. Like, does that mean we should just roll over? Oh, okay, well, you guys are better than us, so I guess we don't matter and we'll just do whatever you say, right?
Exactly. And, you know, you mentioned H.G. Wells. He's a great exemplar of a lot of thoughts on this topic. Not just War of the Worlds is an absolute classic, you know, one of the founding, I would argue, founding novels of science fiction, but one that is really in this space of veganism and science fiction is a book called, lesser known book called, The Island of Dr. Moreau. And this is an interesting one that examines, like, the hubris of humans that want to try to create sentience. And he has a very, very unsympathetic, not, I mean, just sadistically cruel character in it, Dr. Moreau, who is trying to basically operate on animals to give them the ability to speak. And it's an early, it was written all the way back in 1896, like a lot of H.G. Wells stuff was very early. But it brings up all kinds of interesting topics of, you know, so among other things, Dr. Moreau is forcing the animals to act like human beings, not, and against their own biology in these experiments that he's doing on them. And he believes that to be worthy of rights, an animal has to resemble humans and act like them by speaking, walking upright, and following a human-inspired moral law. And I think was, together with Frankenstein by Mary Shelley, even way earlier in 1818.
You also know, were a vegetarian. Some of the,
also a vegetarian. Were our great representatives of the whole idea of, you know, what is our relationship to beings that we affect, or that we bring into creation, you know, which is an increasing topic these days with not only you know, genetically modified organisms and animals, but obviously has relevance to the topic of developing digital AI, artificial intelligences today that may already be sentient and sapient as we speak.
That's interesting. It makes me want to read Dr. Moreau, because I actually don't know much about it beyond, like, Hollywood makes can take these things and make them into kind of a caricature. Although sometimes Hollywood handles things really well. I mean, another example of, like, a talking animal that was done very intelligently is the 1990s movie George of the Jungle.
Right? I have not seen that one. George of the Jungle would be a good one, I'm sure. I think it was, what I remember of it, it was some really good early animation. They had the talking gorilla character, I remember.
Yeah, yeah. John Cleese plays the talking gorilla. No, actually, very silly movie. But and actually, okay, getting back to a more respectable fare, we do sure. have a science fiction clip to play. Which also touches on the stuff we're talking about.
Don't ever sneak up on me like that.
This is my sector. You're not supposed to be here.
An old soldier learns to follow his nose.
Oh, Father, you're always hungry.
I'm not always hungry.
I wonder why they put the food on these little white sticks.
Those are rib bones.
You mean this used to be an animal?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, what a barbaric world.
That must have been some mistake because also another very silly movie, the very first He-Man movie from the 80s, I think, but definitely like A Stranger in a Strange Land moment there. The Stranger in a Strange Land by Robert Heinlein, another example of a vegetarian character from another another place coming here and saying like, what are you guys doing? Like, what the hell, man? Like,
why are you eating other beings? Yeah. There are so many good examples of science fiction novels that take that idea. Certainly, I mean, you know, there's way too many to list them all here. I'm just hitting a few highlights. I hope your listeners will suggest additional ones. But like the Avatar movies, you know, are all about reverence for animals, but in a seeing it through the lens of an alien biosphere, the world Pandora, and how, and you know, showing how the worst elements of humanity can destroy not only the ecosystem of Earth, but try to ravage all the life on Pandora as well. Yeah. And there's tons of other examples that can be cited. The one that I think connects a lot of these themes is a book by Philip K. Dick from 1968, back then, of Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, which became in 1982 the film directed by Ridley Scott, Blade Runner, that most people are more familiar with. But it really, the book I encourage everybody to take a look at, it's in this, many of these stories take place in the dying post-nuclear, you know, apocalyptic world. And in the original book by Philip K. Dick, living animals in this post-nuclear war environment have become either extinct or incredibly rare. And the book links up a lot of sentiments about both animals and then the characters, the beings that are called in the movie series replicants. They're just called androids in the book. But the book goes into a lot of additional thematic discussion of exactly what you were talking about earlier. What does it really mean to be human? What is consciousness? What do we think fundamentally makes a human being? And in this was a topic that Philip Dick was just obsessed with, and he hit it in many of his books. The theme that he came to was that central to being a human being is something, a being that can feel empathy for other sentient beings. And that's why in both the book and the movies, there is this interesting biometric test for empathic reactions. It's called Voight-Kampff in both the book and the movie. That's interesting because in the book, it tests your responses to observing both the suffering of animals and humans. So, the point that Philip Dick was making was that even biologically human individuals are still really androids in the sense of if they have no empathy for other sentient beings. And here you can think about like Auschwitz Nazi guards or slaughterhouse workers interchangeably. And there's also a lot in the novel about sort of a religion based on empathy and compassion with this messiah-like savior called Mercer, who is not in the movie or any of the stuff about the animals didn't make it into the movie. But it's just a fascinating examination, and one of many by Philip Dick, about what it means to be human. You know, what constitutes a human reaction to other sentient beings. I mentioned, you know, those early books, Frankenstein and the Island of Dr. Moreau. Obviously, that idea of affecting other species and uplifting them, or this notion of uplifting them has been represented in a lot of stories. There has a great series called The Uplift Saga by David Brin that explores the idea of uplifting animals like dolphins and chimps to human-level intelligence and ability to communicate. And it raises the next parts of the question that the book, you know, The Island of Dr. Moreau never got around to. Okay, so if an animal is intelligent and can talk, does it finally earn the right to live as it pleases, and does it have the same rights as humans then? It also raises questions that you were just alluding to of paternalism, because in David Brin's books, that Uplift Saga, the animals gain rights, but they then, as a result of being made intelligent, they owe centuries of service to their creators. So it's very paternal and very much like a colonial sort of outlook on entire species that's sort of creepy. An even creepier trilogy of books was the Mad Adam trilogy by Margaret Atwood, 2004 to 2013, which it depicts this just awful and creepy post-plague apocalypse world that was brought about by wealthy humans and exploitative multinational companies engaging in all sorts of genetic experimentation on animals that ultimately backfired and created this plague that killed most of the humans. And the trilogy first, you know, sort of sets that stage in the first book, but then examines in the second book a religious group of apocalypse survivors that are all about gardening, that are strict vegans that want to honor and preserve all plant and animal life. And interestingly to me, these books have been some of the most banned books in recent years, which I thought was fascinating. What else? The Cloud Atlas was a 2004 novel, then again made into a 2012 film that has this complex intertwined set of plots split across different eras and places, and several interrelated themes of sentient rights. And notably in one of the plot lines that both in the book and the movie focuses on a woman named Sanmi 451, who's what's called in that book a fabricant, a humanoid clone. And interestingly, she's indentured as a fast food server in this dystopian future Korean culture, but in this really poignant plot twist during the course of her learning about concepts of freedom and rebelling against oppression, she also learns that she and her fellow clones were bred to ultimately be slaughtered and turned into the fast food that they were serving. You know, so all these series are portrayals that try to get our attention about motivating us towards veganism. But then there's interesting books that explore, well, okay, what does a vegan society look like? And one I'll mention, I know we probably need a break in a minute, but is City by a really early science fiction book, City by Clifford Simak from 1952, which is an interesting book where it shows a series of stories about this future where humans died off over 10,000 years and dogs became the dominant species on Earth. And it's unclear exactly whether this was because of humans improving the dogs or the dogs just evolved over time, or maybe a little both. And what's interesting is that this is an early example of a science fiction story where the species that took over post-humanity became much more compassionate and moral inheritors of the Earth. The future dogs, even though dogs are historically carnivores, they are strictly pacifist and vegetarian and view the web of life as sacred. They intervene in nature by distributing food to other wild animals, including predators, and they manage to convince and educate all the other animals, including the predators, to work together. And yes, Clifford Simak was known to really like dogs, but you can't help wondering, reading these stories, how it actually works. How do the future dogs create a vegan society? And that brings me to the second set of stories, you know, of how science fiction imagines compassionate vegan societies actually work. I think you might have a clip that relates to this.
Yeah, we can come back to that point. And, I had just a couple of responses to stuff.
Yeah, please. About
that, Philip K. Dick, so often I feel like one of his other themes is how society damages us as individuals.
Yes.
And so the struggle to still be sane and be a reasonable, good person, even as society, pushes us this way and that. And so even though it's like a sanitized, made for, not for TV, but, made for a general audience version on Blade Runner, you still have that theme of like, are the replicants actually in a way more human than the humans?
Yes.
Which is...
And absolutely. And that's the flip side of it, that the replicants, if they develop compassion for human beings, can be human. You know, that really is the defining characteristic of a human being. And Philip K. Dick was notorious for showing and being ambiguous on almost all sides of the question. So, that reverence for animals in this post-apocalyptic landscape that is there in the book is also problematized because, he also talks about how humans, because of that reverence for animals, the animal living animals become status symbols, and you're expected to have some sort of, just as a kind of a keeping up with the Joneses thing in the book, you have to have some kind of living animal in your front yard to show that you're affluent.
Oh, man.
And it's stigmatizing if you instead have a robot animal, which that's kind of a confusing part of the movie where Deckard goes into the animal market and you wonder, why do they have all these robot animals? What's that all about? And that's in the book.
Oh, that's interesting.
But it's much more detailed in the book, and they actually, Ridley Scott kind of confuses it with, like, I don't know if you remember the whole thing with the owl and all the comments about the owl, and how there in that part of it, Ridley Scott actually, I think, confused it all by saying the owl was a status symbol of a real owl. Oh, you could, a real robot owl, but that was a mark of stigmatization in the book.
And, that's interesting.
It was fascinating. The book, that is a very interesting book, especially all the stuff about the Mercerism, their religion that Deckard follows in the book, and how he actually, in the book, it's also problematized. He gets visions from Mercer, he thinks, but then in the course of the book, the replicants are trying to convince him that Mercer was a fraud, and it was just a big scam that was put over on people to fool them and get them to buy more products, basically. Oh. So there, it has everything in Philip Dick's stuff has sort of two angles that come at you and make you, think, wait a minute, what really is going on here? That was what he was notorious for.
Well, that's the fascinating thing about science fiction, right, is it makes you think, and there's so many rabbit holes because it has such freedom to explore different possibilities. But it rhymes with reality because, for example, part of the reason why we had this whole mess with COVID is because in China, from what I understand, it's a high status thing to have at a fancy meal to serve a rare animal. So that's why they had this wet market full of these animals,
strange animals, right?
From the captured in the Indonesian rainforest and dragged back to Wuhan, and whether they were also using them for research, whatever exactly happened there, we don't really know, but we do know that there was a wet market full of raccoon dogs, among others, and we do know scientists have found the genetics of early versions of COVID in the blood where they were slaughtering those raccoon dogs. And that was purely just so people could impress their guests at the dinner table. I mean,
exactly.
And all the trouble that we had, and even if you don't care about raccoon dogs, which raccoon dogs care about raccoon dogs, and
right.
I think we should all care about each other, including animals. But even if you don't, like, we didn't have to have that whole escapade if people had been more reasonable in the way that the climate is being destroyed by eating meat because it's the most carbon intensive way to eat food, and all the other consequences. But I also want to jump to the dog book you mentioned, because that was very fascinating to me. I didn't know about that one at all. But it makes sense, like, if dogs were to somehow become capable of civilization, I don't know how their paws are going to work. They have a lot of paw operated machinery. But one thing, it's a question of, like, if we think we're superior to animals, like, superior in what way? Because science has shown, yeah, like, brain scans of dogs, they are much better at sensing the feelings, having empathy, sensing the feelings of other mammals, and especially of humans. You know, in the wild, they're highly cooperative. They operate in a pack. And when they domesticate animals that have had many generations with humans, you know, we humans are not always that great of trying to guess what someone else is feeling and trying to respond appropriately. But dogs are on it. Like, dogs know what people are feeling very accurately. And that's been shown time and time again by the research.
Absolutely. And this whole recent movement towards communicating with animals by, like, dogs and cats, you know, our pets, with assistive technology. You know, we think of that as something mainly for, you know, like Coco the gorilla and other animals. But there's been all these examples of communicating with, you know, like a cat can learn unbelievably 300, a vocabulary of 300 words.
And I didn't, clear, a cat?
Yes.
Okay, they could, but would they bother?
they do. This is so interesting. Okay. The only reason, and I wouldn't have believed this either. I went to this talk by another science fiction writer who is big in this movement, and she got all this, basically these buttons, and you train, and you have the button. What the button can do is when the cat step, or a dog, they also teach dogs this, to step on the button, it says a human word. And you train the animal to understand what that word signifies to humans. And exactly as you're saying, domesticated animals, especially cats and dogs, they resonate with humans. They have been, you know, cohabitating with humans for thousands of years, so they understand a lot of things that a surprising number of things. And I would not have believed this until she showed some of the videos of this cat basically having conversations with her. Now, they're not sophisticated conversations, but clearly the cat has a inner model and an understanding of simple concepts. The way she articulated it was saying that the cat's, you know, basically the cat was like a toddler that was learning a foreign language, and you kind of can see that. And the cat can express its opinions of things, like she taught it the word fabric because she liked to knit little sweaters for the cat. And she would try different sweaters on and see what the cat thought of them. And the cat's curse word, interesting, was pretty much the same as us.
Wait, it was litter box. Have a curse word?
Cats have a curse word. They curse just like us. She would say, you know, this fabric,
can litter you say box. It on the radio?
Yeah, litter box. It.
No, we cannot say. I'm sorry, we cannot say that word.
We can't
on the radio.
Say that word. Well, think of what's in a litter box, okay?
Okay, and, I think we just... cut that word out. But please do. I need to admonish you now because we are on broadcast.
Sure, so. Sure. Okay. So what?
Like Blue, our board operator, was on it and she cut it out. But I'm sorry. So
thank
cats
you.
Say litter box.
Thank you, Blue. Litter cats box. Say litter box as a curse gosh. Word.
That's crazy. I didn't know
I love that.
Cats, and I didn't know that they were teaching cats 300 different words. And
yes.
You know, I recently stepped on a nail last week, and that damn thing went almost all the way through my foot. And I was saying a lot of words you can't say on the radio. And this, and one of the semi-feral cats came running over, and is not always that friendly, but he came running over, and he was just going crazy, rubbing up against my injured foot. Like, just rubbing it this way and that, like, it was almost maniacal. Like, he could tell that I'd hurt my foot, and he was like, he didn't know what to do, but he was like rubbing his back, kind of like, it's okay, it's okay, it's okay, it's okay. And I was like, whoa, that was weird. That was surprising to me. Maybe it shouldn't be. And another time, I had two kittens that we were fostering, and they were in the other room, and apparently one of the kittens, unbeknownst to us, had gotten its neck wrapped up in a piece of string that we had hung up for them to play on. They had managed to like tie a knot in it, and then she got hung on it. She was hanging herself by the string, like she was going to die.
Oh no!
And her sister ran into the other room, and very uncharacteristically for her, started going meow, 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 and then running back in the other room, and then running back and forth. And it was, you know, it was very much like the, you know, you know, like they joke about, like what, Rover? What? Your sister fell down the well? Like, so we ran in there and saw what was going on. And she was like, look, 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 look. So we were able to, like, get her loose. And I mean, she was choking. So that was really interesting to me that in that moment that they knew to communicate. So that makes me think they could be communicating most of the time, but most of the time they just don't. They're like, you know, they're cats. They're like, yeah, I don't want to. But they can when they want to. It's interesting.
So this technology is called augmentative interspecies communication, or AIC. And there's a lot of vendors now of this. So, yeah, I'm fascinated with it too. But clearly animals have a sense of altruism. You know, there's, and clearly there are many examples of interspecies altruism. You know, whales and other, dolphins and other related creatures regularly save human beings that are drowning and keep them afloat. And you know, there's just, and between other species too, there are fascinating examples of, you know, predators that were accidentally raised by an herbivore, you know, fixating on the herbivore as a parent, as a mother figure, and then not killing that, and not, you know, being willing to harm that herbivore when they become mature. So yeah, all of these things inform the kind of the concepts, the stories in these two books I've written. And I'm intrigued with a lot of these notions and how they might play out, how we might experience this in the future.
That's interesting. And we will speak more about your book in a moment. But in preparation for our next clip, I do want to just answer what I imagine a lot of the carnivores listening are thinking. They're saying, yeah, but, you know, animals do eat animals. And that's a really common thing. And I'd like to just go ahead and answer that, because I think that, you know, if humans are in a situation where it's eat an animal or die, if eat an animal or starve, that's an entirely different moral situation than you're looking at a menu and it's like, well, I can have the number one and somebody dies, or I can have the number seven and nobody dies, right? Like yes. The fact that we have, yes, alternatives now, I think puts us in a totally different moral situation. I mean, for that matter, I mean, when is it moral to kill another person so that your family can survive? Or, you know, that's a whole complex question there. But one of the science fiction franchises that has considered this question was authored by a man named Gene Roddenberry. And coming out of the 70s, when he had another go at this science fiction series, he made the second go, at least while he was still in charge, he made it a lot more political. And this next clip is an example of that.
We no longer enslave animals for food purposes.
But we have seen humans eat meat.
You've seen something as fresh and tasty as meat, but inorganically materialized out of patterns used by our transporters.
Okay, of course, that was Commander William T. Riker of the Starship Enterprise. And that was Star Trek The Next Generation from the 80s. And once Roddenberry was gone, I know they backslid and they went back on a whole lot of his stuff. He also imagined in the future people would have no money. Everybody would,
right,
would take care of each other. And you wouldn't have like gambling and prostitution like you end up having on like some of the subsequent series. And but when the first couple seasons of Star Trek, they really delved into that. And I'm not sure that everybody recognizes that, even a lot of people that are fans of Star Trek.
Absolutely. So that clip from Riker in the episode Lonely Among Us is a great example of that, where, you know, the idea was all that they would create food with replicators. So, yes, you know, how do you, yeah, and I was intrigued by that question. Well, what about predatory species, if they, what do they do? You know, like the dogs, you know, what if you had a species that couldn't become vegan? So that, you know, idea, you know, the replicators are sort of magic, but they are, you know, described in various forms of, you know, this idea of vat grown meat or things like meat proteins, substances that would fill that same role potentially for predatory species. And, you know, you mentioned just as a sidebar, the question of, well, how does the economy work in Star Trek if you can just replicate anything? There's a lot of really good fans that explore that, super fan YouTubers like Steve Shives. This is a guy that does a Star Trek YouTube channel that analyzed that question of what post-money replicator economies in Star Trek would look like. But that concept has also been explored in a lot of other series like The Expanse by James Corey. That was both a book series and the TV series on the Sci-Fi Network. And in that, it also portrays future human civilization that, because of the logistical nightmare, primarily of trying to raise livestock in space, vat-grown proteins are the norm. And I thought that one was, that series and books were interesting because they highlight how veganism might also become a necessity just because of physics rather than a solely moral choice. And, you know, I explore that idea in my books, specifically, you know, because I thought about that, you know, and I have this one species that is the eventual female character in the books that is a predatory species. But even she has effectively gone in a direction that doesn't harm other sentient beings because in part of the backstory, the world building of the future universe, there is this species called I call them the Brentasians. And they were inspired by real world patterns in trees on Earth. So a lot of trees, a huge number of trees, pines, and a lot of and other sorts of trees have synergistic, symbiotic relationships with fungi, species of fungi that are fascinating in that the trees need ways of the trees can't get a lot of mineral nutrients like phosphorus and nitrogen from the soil, but fungi are very good at digging that out of the dirt. And so there are these vast networks that were called the Wood Wide Web by Suzanne Simard. She was an ecologist to describe this sophisticated subterranean exchange that the scientists have studied in exchanges between different types of plants. And there are these huge underground networks of mycorrhizal fungi is what they're called, where trees shuttle, they can use this network of fungi to shuttle excess sugar that the trees produce via photosynthesis to other trees through the fungi. And the fungi get the sugar, which they can't produce because they're not above ground and they don't photosynthesize. But the trees can produce it, and the fungi provide them with these nutrients of phosphorus and nitrogen. So I imagined that, you know, that inspired me. I was thinking about this. Okay, so there are probably, I could imagine, species that are like trees that create pods of proteins and fats and other sorts of just nutrients that they could feed things that were creatures on other planets that are more like human beings in exchange for symbiotic relationships and benefits from these other species. And so in this future, they actually eat these predatory species, like the one I was mentioning, eat these pods that are produced through these Brentasian meat forests. That it's not really meat, it's pods of proteins, but they get produced in exchange for symbiotic benefits with other species, including star traveling species. So, you know, I try to explore a lot of different symbiotic and mutualistic relationships among species in these books in different ways by the different things I explore.
That's really interesting. We've got such a lengthy bibliography for this episode, and a lot of things for people to think about or read up on. And in the remaining 10 minutes or so, or 9 minutes, I'd like to hear more about your book, but in introductory to that, there's a point that I want to make, because at the moment, you know, like all of us, I'm deeply concerned about what our idiot president has done, gotten us into in the Middle East. And yep. I feel like this relates to some of the topics in your book, because these monks, they're like monks of information, right? They're not religious.
Right.
And I feel like even though religion is fascinating to study, and the good intentions of religion and the ethics of different world religions are often very deep and would improve the world immensely if we were to follow the morality of religion, you know, we know that contradictory religions, they can't all be true. And we know that religion is twisted in all sorts of ways, like the way that, you know, this Christo-fascism that Trump represents. Not that I don't think he believes it, he's just willing to milk it. Another example would be the way that Israel, particularly the Israeli settlers, right now they take every opportunity to steal more Palestinian land and attack Palestinians. And knowing that they're just, even when they commit murder, they know they're just going to get a slap on the wrist. And having the government of Israel look the other way. So I want to throw out sympathy to them. I want to throw out sympathy to everyone on all sides that are trapped in the cycles of violence that are raging in the Middle East, and pray that it doesn't spread any further. And that there's so many examples of religion causing harm. The Spanish conquest, you know, was often justified. The mission system was used in an exploitative way, and the conquest was often justified as like a means of spreading religion. Slavery in the United States was often explicitly justified by some of the words of Paul in the Bible, because we know that Paul, living under the Roman system, which was a system of slavery, Paul specifically endorses slavery. So you can use that bit of the Bible if it's 1843 and you're like, yeah, slavery, it's not so bad. That's, you know, the book says it's okay. Obviously, eating animals is often justified by religion. And then the abuse of gay people around the world. For example, in the Iraqi constitution, many other places, it's still death penalty to be gay. And that's justified based on religious rules. So I'm curious about when you decided to make these men on a mission to rescue the bereft and to spread knowledge, spread enlightenment. Why did you choose this model of the monk, and why is there an abbot, and why are they sojourners? Why all these trappings of religion? Like what were you thinking?
Right, well, that's a great question, Patrick. And that was such a rich, you know, set of things that you just alluded to. You're absolutely right on all of those counts. So why this structure for the sojourners? Basically, I wanted to portray a group that had a strong moral code and that had the motivation as strong as a religious one, but you're quite right, they are completely secular and scientific in this group of them. The reason for the trappings is precisely to try to convey a point that, well, this is also a big topic in Dune, of the motivations of religious systems or systems of thought that capture human imagination around core precepts. And what I wanted these guys to really strongly and completely believe in and embody were altruistic principles. And so as a way of conveying that, both as a way in story of the backstory of them, you know, trying to create an organization that had that kind of strong an embodied motivation, but also as a way of quickly conveying to the reader sort of the ambiance and the level of commitment of these of this group is the reason for all this monastic portrayal of the sojourners. Also because in the book that I was inspired by, again, Journey of the West, the main character is a Buddhist monk. And there are a lot of similarities between the monk character Tripitaka in the Journey to the West and this main character of the Sojourner Saga, Grimalkin Thomas. But yes, there's this one passage in the first chapter of the book where when they encounter a group of bereft people, this older, bereft, primitive gentleman asks this young monk, well, what gods do you and these other holy people believe in then, boy? And Grimalkin, you know, he thinks carefully about what he's going to answer. And he says, well, the way he expresses it is, we have faith, but our faith is in the wonder of scientific inquiry and compassion. We believe in loyalty to all humanity and knowledge is how he responds to that. And you're right, there is a recurring theme. It is hard to not get discouraged these days, but like a mutual friend of ours, Tom Hartman, says, you know, the despair is not an option, but there is that sentiment one can't help struggle against. So in the story, and again in that first chapter, the old man replies to him.
1 minute, well, by the way.
Sure. Sure. I will finish with this then.
Oh, this is a great finish.
Your wonder and compassion are bright gods to follow, but I fear our dark gods of tyranny and cruelty may still be more powerful, and I hope they do not follow us here because our gods hate us. And yeah, I think the dark gods of tyranny and cruelty are all too real out there these days, but I still have faith in the gods of wonder and compassion. So, and I was inspired, where I got the idea for the Sojourners actually was when I worked at the National Science Foundation. I was so impressed by the diligence and commitment of all the people in the National Science Foundation. They really were my colleagues there were the inspirations for the Sojourners, because they really believe in benefits of science to humanity.
And so if we want to find out whether despair wins or not in the end, I guess we have to read your books.
Yes. Yes, indeed. So take a look at my books, Helmsman and Pilgrim. You can find links to them on my website, sojourner.eposian.com. And you can read all about them there.
Well, thank you very much. We've been talking to Dr. Martin Halbert here on Vegan World Radio on KPFT 90.1 FM. We are true community radio paid for by our listeners. Thank you once again for everybody who donated in our last fund drive. And we'll see you back here at the same time next week.
Hey now, KPFT listeners and members. KPFT turned 56 years old March 1st, and we're going to celebrate on March 29th with a crawfish boil. $75 is the cost of admission for one, $130 for two. Tickets are available at kpft.org or by calling 713-526-5738, option 1. Hope to see you out there as we pinch and peel. Your admission comes with unlimited crawfish, two drink tickets, and a heck of a good time.
And it ought to be a great day, I guarantee you.
See you out there, March 29th, Sunday, 1 to 5 p.m., 607 East Whitney. Get your tickets in advance. No tickets at the door. KPFT Houston.
You are listening to KPFT Houston. I'm Michael Woodson, your producer and host of Living Art. We air on Wednesday night at 7. Tune in. Won't you join us for Art Talk?
Welcome to Whole Mother. This is Kate.